September 20th, 2025, Abhayagiri Monastery. And feels like it's been a good day, long day of practice. I was very happy to be doing the 108 ETPSO recitation with a group up at the ordination platform. One, just because it was nice to practice outside all afternoon. It's nice to sit outside. And then at first it was kind of hot. We started at about 1 and ended just before 4. And it was kind of hot at first, but then we all found shady patches. And then through the day, it just got cooler and some cool breezes came up. And just really nice to be outside, really just sitting and practicing and chanting or whatever practices we do outside. It's just really nice being outside. And we are a forest monastery, so that does promote outside practice. And definitely highly recommended. So as many people know, I've been dealing with this sciatica condition, my back, for about 7 months now. And it's actually, it's not really bad right now and hasn't been very bad for the past couple months. But it's just kind of this like always there kind of dull ache. And I've learned a lot about how to look after it. And I'm actually really getting pretty good at working with it. And it's amazing how what we can adapt to over time. And also, of course, there's that reflection that there's always somebody who has it much worse than I do. And I'm very fortunate to still have the ability to walk, for example, which many people in the world don't. Many people in the world have chronic conditions or injuries that take away their ability to walk. And that's, I can't imagine how hard it must be for those people. And some people who have serious injuries where they lose their ability to walk, they actually consider it was a good thing because the mind's able to let go into it. They're able to experience a strong sense of contentment within that debilitated or disabled condition. But then for some people, they become very, very depressed, and that's totally understandable as well. And so how do we work with these kind of things? And I actually thought of an analogy that it is similar to the Buddha when he talks about the deathless and his realization of the deathless, because this idea of the back and say like a bulging disc in the back, and what I need is decompression. Anything that can decompress the back is good. So one thing I've been working with is hanging, just kind of hanging from there's a wooden beam at my kuti, which is the perfect size for hanging from, and my feet can just barely touch the ground, so it decompresses the back. But the problem with that is then it decompresses other parts of the back that shouldn't be decompressed. So it decompresses the part that needs to be decompressed, but it also decompresses other parts that shouldn't be decompressed, and then those parts start hurting. The one part feels a bit better, but then the other parts get sore. And so, okay, so then there's this, I need to understand decompression at a deeper level. And everybody says that, for this particular condition, you need decompression. But then looking at a certain type of decompression, and then I was thinking, why does sitting hurt so much? Why does sitting aggravate it so much? And why is standing and walking so good? Why is sitting and lying down so bad for it? And why is standing and walking so good for it? And I was looking at, that's when I sit, that's compression. The torso is pushing straight down on the floor, so that's compressing it. But when I stand, the weight is going down to the feet. The compression is in the feet rather than in the back. So when I sit, the compression's in the lower back because the bottom of the back is directly touching the ground. But when I stand or walk, then the compression is going down at the bottom of the feet. That the compression changes locations. And so hence, yes, of course, standing and walking is more comfortable. And then that naturally decompresses the back a little bit more and it's less painful. And also understanding that just there are things that decompress just that one point. So that needs to be decompressed. And so there's techniques for that, like, for example, rolling up a towel and putting it in your stomach area and then doing a child's pose over that. And then that stretches that only that one part of the back. It took a long time to discover things like that. And it's just like picking up little things here and there, and through investigation, through mindfulness and investigation, picking up little things that start working really well. And so I found to understand decompression, I had to understand compression. So the Buddha says, before he could understand the deathless, he had to understand death first. He couldn't understand the deathless unless he understood the other side of it first. So I think this is a good analogy, because I had this kind of insight yesterday where I can't understand decompression if I don't understand compression. What's compressing it? Only then can I understand decompression. And the Buddha said he couldn't realize the deathless until he understood the realm of death. Once he fully understood the realm of death, i.e. the conditioned world, only then could he understand the deathless. So I find this is a phenomenon where we want to know what the deathless is. We want to know what Nibbana is. We want to know what the goal of practice is. But we're not so interested in understanding the things that need to be understood in order to realize it. What needs to be understood? Impermanence needs to be understood. Suffering needs to be understood. Not self needs to be understood. And those things that we maybe don't want to look at, suffering, for example, that needs to be understood. It needs to be brought inward. So the Buddha is talking about the deathless isn't realized through just pondering what the deathless is, but it's realized through looking at these conditions which bind us to suffering, and these things that cause clinging and dissatisfaction, disease in the mind and the heart. Then when we look at those things, we gain insight into those things, and we go into those things and really look at it and try to see what is it, where are we stuck, what's that thing that can't be extracted from the heart. Why aren't we able to have a sense of ease and well-being all the time? What's stopping us from that? It's because we don't yet understand this sense of, you could call it compression. What's compressing us? What's pressing on the heart? What is squeezing on the heart in a way that's causing us suffering? And then how do we release it? So that would be decompression. How do we release the clinging? How do we release, let go of that which we're holding on to? So recently I've been talking quite a bit about forgiveness, which is abhayadana. This is abhayagiri. So we talk about abhayadana. Abhaya means fearless. Dana means giving. So the giving of fearlessness. And the Buddha defines that as giving forgiveness. By giving forgiveness, we give fearlessness, because when we truly forgive somebody, say we've been at odds with somebody, and then we go out on a limb and we truly forgive them. We forgive them and we mean it. We don't just do it as a kind of paying lip service to forgiveness, but we actually forgive, we actually mean it. Then there's a sense of trust there, and that person no longer has to be afraid that we're going to do something bad to them, get them back or whatever. So that gives fearlessness. So with the abhayadana, then giving forgiveness. So when we investigate compression or we investigate suffering, then we see that, this is one thing, say holding on or not forgiving, holding grudges, holding a sense of aversion toward people or situations, then that's pressing on the heart, that's squeezing on the heart in a bad way, that's causing us harm. And we're doing it to ourselves, and that's not a judgment, because we're all doing it. And even monks are doing this as well. Monks are people too, so we're doing this as well. And this is something that's wonderful and marvelous about the Buddha's teaching, in that the Buddha never judges anybody. The Buddha just says, this is what causes suffering. If you want to stop suffering, do this. But it's up to you. I'm not going to judge you for continuing to suffer. So the Buddha is compassionately teaching us to try to get us to stop suffering, but he's not character judging anybody. He's just saying, laying it out there, saying, okay, well, if you want to do it, it's up to you. It's up to you to do the work. Just, this is what leads to suffering. This is what leads to happiness. This is what leads to release. And you can choose. It's like you go into a store, you can choose what to buy. And nobody's going to say, like, you have to buy this, you have to buy that. So the Buddha is just laying it all out there for us. And he's just, that's the Dhammadana. That's the offering of Dhamma from the Buddha, that he's realized all these things and say, okay, well, this is what you have to do. If you want this, you can get it. So we have to understand compression before we can understand decompression. Everybody will say we need decompression, but then we can't really get it for ourselves if we understand for ourselves what compression is. So everybody will say, or maybe not everybody, but Buddhists will say that you need the deathless. You need to realize the deathless. But then we can't do that without understanding death, understanding the realm of the impermanent. And so when we investigate that, we can see clearly, say, impermanence is actually the realization we're looking for. We may have studied about something like the different stages of awakening in the Pali Canon. So we have the stream enterer, the once returner, the non-returner, and the arahant. So the stream enterer is said to have, there's 10 fetters that the Buddha talks about binding the heart to samsara, keeping it from the nibbana. So first three fetters are said to fall away at stream entry. And that's in Pali, we'll have it Sakaya Ditti, Silabhata Paramasa, and Vijikicca. Sakaya Ditti is normally translated as personality view or personality belief. I would think of it as the coarse sense of self, taking this body and mind to be me and mine. So that sense of ownership of me, that's Sakaya Ditti. And it's not the final conceit, which only falls away at arhantship. There's a final conceit, which called Asmimana, which falls away at arhantship. That's the conceit I am. So a stream enterer still has that. But Sakaya Ditti, the kind of sense of self, the coarse sense of self, falls away. Silabhata Paramasa, attachment to precepts and practices or rites and rituals, or you could say even attachment to marks, attachment to conditions. And then Vichikicca, which is doubt. This is defined in a couple ways. One is kind of the more well-known or obvious one, which would be one no longer has doubt in Buddha Dhamma Sangha. But then the Buddha also defines it in some places as one is no longer perplexed by what is right and wrong. One is no longer perplexed by wholesome and unwholesome states. And I think perhaps for me, that type of doubt falling away is, that's more useful, thinking of doubt in that way. One no longer has any doubt about this is wholesome, this is unwholesome. So a stream enterer might do something unwholesome, but they'll know right away, this is unwholesome. There's no doubt. There's no doubt about it. What I just did was unwholesome, and I'm going to stop doing that. So the mind is propelled much more. It's in the stream, so it's propelled much more into the wholesome dhammas. But there's a misunderstanding where we might think, okay, so then I really want to become a stream enterer, so I need to work on my Sakaya Ditti, I need to work on my Silabhata Paramasa, and I need to work on my Vichikicca. I need to work on my sense of self, get rid of that. I need to get the... If only it was so easy. I need to get rid of my sense of self and need to stop attaching to rites and rituals. So need to stop doubting. So, but then the thing about that is we can actually strengthen those things through doing that. Those things don't fall away through trying to lessen those things or focusing directly on them. But those three things fall away as a byproduct of the realization into impermanence. So you get like the Dhammacakka Sutta with Anyakondanya saying, oh, he's the first stream enterer, so he's, all that arises passes away, that and his Dhamma eye opens, and those three things fall away at that time, but it wasn't from him focusing on those three things. So it's good to get our minds around that, because say, oh, I need to get, you know, I have too much of a sense of self, or this is popular in the kind of lay retreat circles, is I'm selfing again, like, this kind of turning it into a verb. There I am, selfing again. Yeah. So it's not really let go of in that way. Or Silabhata Paramasa. Okay, I have to stop chanting, stop bowing. That's attachment to rites and rituals. But then doing that is also attachment to rites and rituals, if we think about it, because anything that we religiously do and we think that that action in and of itself is going to liberate us. So if we think chanting and bowing in and of itself, those actions in and of themselves are going to bring liberation to us, or we think a certain mantra in and of itself in doing that mantra is going to bring liberation to us, that's Silabhata Paramasa. That's the very definition of it. And also, if we think by not chanting and by not bowing and by not doing mantras is going to bring liberation to us, that's also Silabhata Paramasa, because that's saying some condition is going to bring me liberation. So we have to be careful about that, about no Buddha images. No, with those, if we think by not having a Buddha image that we're going to be liberated, that's also Silabhata Paramasa. So we just need to know why we do all these things. But the Silabhata Paramasa, the attachment to rites and rituals, falls away when we realize the insight into impermanence, because we then see the usefulness of certain actions that we do. For example, bowing is good for establishing mindfulness, having a sense of respect, and so on. And we see the usefulness of it, but we don't cling to it as being something which is going to liberate us in and of itself. The liberation is dependent on the mind. So vichikicca, the doubt, you know, might be, okay, well, I just need to study more. I need to read more suttas. I need to get over my doubt. I need to maybe read more books of different traditions and kind of figure out which tradition is going to be right for me. And then I'll stop doubting, because I'll finally find the right teaching, which is going to be kind of just kind of everything's going to click. And then I won't have doubt anymore. But that's focusing on doubt from focusing on doubt. That's trying to get rid of doubt through focusing on doubt, which is doubtful that it's going to help. But through the insight into impermanence, that's when there's that sense of perplexity can fall away. So then, we have this, they talk about the once returner, which is, so the stream enterer, it's said that there's no eighth life. So the Kripa Ajahns have this way of speaking, there's no eighth life, that most will be reborn seven more times, and it'll never be in the lower realms. It'll always be as either a human or a deva. And so it'll only be in the realms of happiness, the upper realms. So through those three fetters falling away, that's one of the results, is that the mind can't drop. There's a threshold it can't go below. It can't go below a certain threshold of suffering. And then the once returner, no more fetters fall away, but greed, hatred, and delusion is attenuated further. And they say, oh, you'll only come back once more and then become liberated. But either way, you're guaranteed arhantship at some point. And then the non-returner, they say that's more someone who develops super samadhi. And if they don't penetrate further, they get reborn in the pure abodes, or what we call the pure realms. So we do have pure realm it's called the Sudawasas, the pure abodes, the pure realms. In Theravada, we do have that, and it refers to the non-returner. And so the non-returner is the one who doesn't get reborn as a human again, but they reappear in a pure land, and there they attain awakening after 80,000 aeons or something. So up there for a super long time. And then with the three more fetters, the greed and aversion have fallen away for lust, no more lust for an anagami, for a non-returner. But they still have, so there's two more fetters that fall away there, but then they still have five fetters left. So it gives you the sense that even, you might think the experience of an anagami and arhant is, they're very, very similar, but I think they're worlds apart, actually. The arhant is the way of experience of an arhant is totally different than an anagami, although most of us don't have to worry about this, but it is interesting. There's five more fetters. There's the attachment to the form jhanas, attachment to the form attainments, attachment to the formless absorptions. Then there's restlessness. So amazingly, restlessness only ends at arhantship. So, but this is not restlessness as we normally think about it. This is like any little blip in the mind. And then there's the asmimana, the conceit I am, only falls away at that point. And also ignorance. Avijja finally falls away. So you have actually five more fetters that So half of the fetters don't fall away until full enlightenment. So those things come through every step of the way the Buddha talks about. There's a sutta, which is, I believe, is actually attributed to Sariputta, the Buddha's foremost student in wisdom. And he's having a Dhamma conversation with another arhant, but sometimes arhants ask each other questions, perhaps for the benefit of others later on. And Sariputta is asked, well, what does a stream enterer practice? Well, seeing the five khandhas, form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, seeing and contemplating the five khandhas as anicca, dukkha, anatta, so impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self. Then he says, well, how does a once returner practice? He says, well, seeing the five khandhas as anicca, dukkha, anatta. How does a non-returner practice? Well, seeing the five khandhas as anicca, dukkha, anatta. Well, how does an arhant practice then? And he says, well, an arhant practices by seeing the five khandhas as anicca, dukkha, and anatta. And then his questioner says, well, why does an arhant need to practice that? Because an arhant has finished their work, done what needs to be done, ended all suffering, ended all ignorance, and so on, cut the fetters of being, won't come anymore to birth in this world. And well, when the Sariputta says, well, when the arhant reflects on the five khandhas thus, with mindfulness, he dwells in a pleasant abiding here and now. So that's just his habit, and the path is established in him. So the path, and it's also said that the Noble Eightfold Path becomes the Noble Tenfold Path for the arhant, so that we chanted the Noble Eightfold Path this evening, but then the ninth factor of the path would be right. So there's, say, the Noble Eightfold Path is right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi, right concentration. So then there's the ninth one, which is right liberation. And then the tenth factor is right knowledge and vision of liberation. So rather than you could think that wrong liberation, there's actually wrong liberation. So we might have some sort of deep meditative attainment and then overestimate ourselves. We overestimate our attainments, and this can happen as well. So people would go to the Buddha and actually claim attainments. This is something that was done in the time of the Buddha, and also in the practice circles, it's done in Thailand for people who actually reach lofty heights of distinction in their practice. So practitioners would go, monks, nuns, go to the Buddha and declare that they had attained something. And if it was arhantship, some people would say, you know, okay, I've finished my work, or I've reached arhantship. And then some people would go to the Buddha and say, they wouldn't say anything about attainments, but they just say form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness are impermanent and not self. And then they would leave. And the Buddha said, that's the real claim. He said, that's how arhants declare their attainment to me. He said, if somebody comes and tells me I'm an arhant, they've fallen into overestimation, because an arhant would never say that. Without asmimana, you can't say that. You can't actually say that to somebody. But you can say, you can declare your wisdom through declaring the unsatisfactory and not self nature of the five khandhas. So he would say, so if somebody comes to you, and so according to the Buddha, if somebody comes and says they're an arhant, nope, they're not. Definitely not. By definition, they're not, because with the asmimana, they wouldn't be able to say that. That there's that still that sense of I am. I mean, it's in the statement, I am an arhant. You know, if somebody says I am something and they hold to that, then that's not it, because that's the conceit I am right there. So it's rearing its head. In fact, it's probably still Sakaya Ditti if it's that coarse. It's probably still not even to the level of stream entry. So I don't know any examples of this lately, but I'm just talking about in general terms about these things, because I find it very interesting. So anyway, it's been a long day. Just it's time to go to the kuti and decompress. And so I think, but it's just an important to remember there's compression and decompression, and we need to actually put that effort into understanding the conditioned realm, even though it is unpleasant, but that's, we're in it. I mean, we are in this condition. And so we do need to investigate and understand these things. And like Lungpa Liem would say that the only way is through, then it's going into the suffering. Not that we're making ourselves suffer, but then we investigate and look, what is really causing this? Really, what is this really coming from? And then gaining that insight into it. Leave this for reflection this evening.